May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. I'm Ed Gill, and we respectfully submit on behalf of Mr. Banther that this constitutes the appeal from the state's third failed attempt to convict Mr. Banther legally of the crimes of murder in the first degree and possession of a deadly weapon during the commission of a felony. What is apparent from the record in this case is the willingness of the state to do just about anything to sustain a conviction. We, for over a decade, the Department of Justice went before the court and represented to the court and prosecuted to the court that Mr. Banther and a gentleman by the name of John Schmitz worked together over an extended period of time to plan, substantial planning, which they used actually to attempt to get the death penalty for Mr. Banther after his first trial, to kill an acquaintance of theirs, a business acquaintance actually, Dennis Ravers. They took that position even as they, after we went through the first two trials, as we prepared for the third trial of this matter. On A67 in the appendix, the prosecutor indicated that he still believed that there was an agreement, a conspiracy between Banther and Schmitz to kill Mr. Ravers. And on A69, admits on the record, again before the third trial, that he cannot tell who actually struck the fatal blows in this case. This was an axe murder. Yet, when the matter came to trial at Banther 3, the state took the position at argument at the close of the case that one and only one person was involved in the killing of Dennis Ravers, and that was John Schmitz. And that was the state's position that they took in the argument in this case. The state requested an over-defense objection, received an accomplice liability instruction in Banther 3. And while the state did not argue at all to the jury any basis for accomplice liability, because there is none in the record, when the state was forced to ask for the answer for the basis of accomplice liability on appeal, in its brief, its answering brief, it came up with, and it argued to this court, what's what I call the burn barrel theory, that Mr. Schmitz and Mr. Banther, after the axing had occurred, placed poor Mr. Ravers in a burn barrel, and Mr. Ravers was still breathing, and they took him to a different site and chopped his body with an axe to try to force him into the burn barrel and burned him. And that actually killed him. Now, to be clear, while the state did not argue at all to the jury this theory, because, quite frankly, it was not supported by any evidence, the state did argue it to the trial judge in support of the state's argument at the prayer conference to receive the accomplice liability instruction. When the state, this matter came for oral argument in October of 2008, the state stood at this very podium and argued before this same panel that in response to the questions from the court, that the very basis for the accomplice liability theory was this burn barrel theory. The court directed supplemental memorandum in this case, and while it appears to me, at least, and the court will make the interpretation, that the state has not completely abandoned this burn barrel theory, now the state, once again, just like it did in attempting to shift theories as to who killed Dennis Ravers, the state now has basically in supplemental memorandum asked this court to allow that a jury could have basically invented a Travis-type scenario at the trial level, even though that has never been argued, even though in this court's decision in Banther 2, this court explicitly stated, quote, the state's repeated argument to the jury never addressed the kind of unilateral spontaneity discussed in Travis, close quote. And the fact that the state didn't even argue this when addressed with a question in October. The weight to be given to the state's argument is made even worse, is respectfully submitted, by the fact that the state argued in January 2008 stood in a courtroom and said that that man, meaning Bruce Banther, and that man alone killed Dennis Ravers. And yet, John Schmitz, since 1997, has been sitting in jail, and since it's now a year and 4 months since the state made that argument in a courtroom that he had nothing to do with the murder of Dennis Ravers, and yet that man, John Schmitz, now for his dozen years sits in jail when the state simply could go to the court and say, look, we've got the wrong man. We know he didn't do this. We reasonably believe he didn't do this, at least, but yet lets him sit in a jail. And it will argue to this court today, apparently, that they could reasonably submit that evidence to the court. The errors in the trial process are such that Mr. Banther was completely deprived of his right to a fair trial. And the first argument, which we submitted in the brief, deals expressly with the acquittal in Banther 1 on the conspiracy, and this court's decision in not only Banther 1 but Banther 2, which prevented the state, as it must under 11 Delaware Code Section 208 and principles of double jeopardy, from pursuing a conviction on a conspiracy theory. The reasons why that created problems for the state are numerous. One, at the outset of this trial, found on page C8, January 10th of 2008, the defense asked the judge, the trial court, to give a curative instruction, because what the state did in this case was essentially ignore the orders of this court and present, as the state admits in its brief in this matter, presented the same evidence that it had presented in Banther 1 and Banther 2. Now, the one exception, obviously, is they added, but they still presented the same evidence. The same evidence, which they argued forcefully to not only this court, but the two prior juries, constituted evidence of a planning, substantial planning, agreement, conspiracy between Mr. Schmitz and Mr. Banther to kill Mr. Ravers. So obviously there's a different way that someone could interpret this evidence. But yet the trial judge, from the outset, failed to give a curative instruction. The defense, witness after witness after witness after piece of evidence, repeatedly voiced this objection. This was argued in our opening brief, argument one. The state did not respond. As quite frankly, we contend the state has no response. There is no justification for not giving a curative that you can use the evidence for this purpose, but not that. I still have not heard any response, either in oral argument or in written argument.
Well, the charge of conspiracy wasn't before the jury, was it?
The charge of, no. And that's basically the remedy which the trial court in the state attempted in the second trial was, well, just don't use the word conspiracy. But all the evidence, all the same evidence.
Well, forget about the word conspiracy. There was no indictment on a charge of conspiracy before the jury, correct?
Correct. Absolutely.
Well, maybe this is the time to articulate for us what analysis we bring to bear and why this is error, to present evidence that's arguably consistent with a conspiracy, but it isn't argued that it's a conspiracy and the defendant's not charged with conspiracy. So what's the point?
Because the jury, or one juror for that matter, there need not be unanimity of theories in how a jury goes ahead and convicts. One juror, or 12 for that matter, could have, and as the state force has argued, could have found that on the basis of this conspiracy that occurred, that we're going to go ahead and convict Mr. Banther in this case. And that, in fact, is in all probability what occurred due to the way that this entire process worked. We also moved for judgment of acquittal in this case at the close of the state's evidence on accomplice liability theory. And the court said this was basically an issue to go to jury instructions and did not really give any sort of analysis as to why an accomplice liability theory could go any further, other than this burn barrel, which I'll talk about, is not valid.
And the state, when did you first know that the accomplice liability theory was going to be pursued at the third trial?
We tried to be aware to try to deal with that. You can probably tell from when you read the transcript of all the questions that defense counsel kept asking. We don't know the law, Judge. Can we have some clarifications? Can we have this curative instruction as to what purpose the same evidence about the conspiracy is being used for? And the court never would go ahead and give us that. And so we argued forcefully throughout the entire, well, we thought forcefully throughout the entire trial, even after the end of the state's argument, because the state never argued anything about accomplice liability, as from the quote I point out from Banther 2.
I'm trying to follow up on the Chief Justice's question. Tell us the relief you wanted and the reversible error. It appears that conspiracy was out of the case, but this conspiracy evidence was coming in. It now appears that accomplice liability was in the case, and certainly the jury was instructed on that. You now tell us you made a motion for a judgment of acquittal on accomplice liability. You appear to be saying that somewhere along the line, the judge should have told the jury, conspiracy is not in the case. Even though you may hear evidence about working together, the state's not alleging a conspiracy, he's not being charged with a conspiracy. I suspect the state would have said, nevertheless, although we think in this third trial Banther's the principal, we're also pursuing him as an accomplice. Therefore, this evidence is not evidence of a conspiracy, but you can consider it as evidence of accomplice liability. Now, if all of that had taken place, I assume you have a problem with that. So what should the trial judge have done, and how should he have done it?
Well, something along the lines of what Your Honor just articulated there should have been given from that very first witness who talked about the conspiracy, basically, and the agreement. That's the curative instruction should have been given. The motion for judgment of acquittal should have been granted, since there was no sufficient evidence upon which the jury could have reasonably found, any jury could have found evidence of accomplice liability, because the state never argued Travis. They should not be permitted to go ahead and now say that the same evidence which showed the agreement, which we always argued was an agreement, now shows a Travis-like theory.
Why? Why can't they change theories?
Well, due process, Your Honor.
Well, okay. But it's not an ipsy-dixit. Explain to me how that violates the due process clause.
It violates, and that's... In the second argument that we make here, again, as I pointed out at the beginning of my argument, the state always took the position that Banther and Schmitz did this together. And they presented evidence in this case of things that actually John Schmitz did without even Bruce Banther being there. He went and borrowed a truck from somebody and lied to the person about why he was borrowing the truck, saying he was going on a date, but he was actually going out there apparently to kill Dennis Ravers and wait, lay in wait and do that. And it is just, again, it violates the sense of justice and fundamental fairness to stand before a court in 1999 and say, Mr. Schmitz, you're going to plead guilty to this, and we're going to accept your guilty plea to murder in the second degree and let you sit in jail for 20 years, 12 of which he still has, but yet stand before a jury in a courtroom and say, Schmitz had nothing to do with it. Banther's the only person who did this. The state should not be allowed to do that. And again, if justice is going to stand for anything, the Department of Justice cannot and should not be allowed to stand there and argue both ways that Schmitz is guilty, you sit in jail, but then when it suits their purposes to try to convict Banther, oh, Schmitz had nothing to do with it, because the state could not proceed on the conspiracy theory legally under where we were beforehand. The state could not proceed on that theory. And they didn't trust, obviously, the theory of Schmitz just coming in there and saying, I didn't have anything to do with it.
Let's help us focus on your legal argument, which seems to have two points. Your first argument is that, and this is the difficulty from a general point of view, in a normal case, you can charge someone as a principal. And then at the end of all the trial evidence, we've said many times, it's permissible to let it go to the jury under an accomplice liability theory. So that's the general rule. You seem to be saying that shouldn't apply in this case for two reasons. First, the state shouldn't be allowed to make that argument at all because it took a contrary position in the past. Or, second, they shouldn't be able, it should have never been presented to the jury because there were insufficient evidence. So is that your legal argument?
There's more. The insufficient evidence is the judgment of acquittal. The failure to give the court the curative is the...
The insufficient evidence not only goes to the judgment of acquittal, it's whether there's evidence to support the lesser, the alternative theory. So it works in both places, doesn't it?
Yes, sir. The jury instruction.
Right.
In this case also. But there's more to the jury instruction because we objected. We argued, obviously, no accomplice liability instruction at all. The court gave an accomplice liability instruction, didn't focus on the unilateral spontaneity that this court, the Supreme Court, required, didn't, under the Allen theory, didn't go ahead and focus the jury on the specific state of mind of what the accomplice would be. Didn't give any instruction to that effect. And the defense did specifically request a jury instruction. It's counterintuitive for a juror, a judge, a lawyer, I would think for anyone, to believe that if there was an agreement between Schmitz and Banther to kill Ravers, that therefore you must acquit. That's got to be particularly very difficult for a juror to go ahead and understand. But the judge did nothing and did not give our requested instruction to go ahead and focus on that issue.
But you've answered my question. I see you're in the time you reserve. I don't want to take it up anymore.
Yeah, I do just want to finish on one point. And again, I think the state has basically admitted, and obviously I'm eating on my rebuttal time, I understand that, but the state has pretty much admitted in its supplemental brief many of the points that we're trying to make here, because again, the state has told this court in its supplemental memorandum that this man could have been convicted in Banther 3 on the burn barrel theory. And yet if you look at the state's supplemental memorandum on page 16, it talks about such close and extensive cooperation. In other words, a conspiracy between Banther and Schmitz the jury could have found. Now, of course, the burn barrel theory can't work for all the reasons I set forth, including there's no evidence of that. There was a cause of death from a medical examiner, the wrong weapon, there was no axe, obviously, in the burn barrel, and, of course, this conspiracy, which was cooperation. And the state cites to Swan and Norcross for basically the theory that, hey, if two people are out there and they both walk away and somebody else is dead, that therefore you can convict both of them. It doesn't matter if they show who did it. Respectfully, this court indicated in Swan that occurs where there is compelling evidence that the defendants planned and jointly carried out the criminal enterprise. And, of course, that's what the state was prohibited from doing in this case legally. So, respectfully, for those reasons, Your Honor, members of the court, the state cannot switch theories at this point in time to go to this unilateral theory that Banther did it himself. They cannot convict on the conspiracy theory. After this third attempt, it is respectfully submitted that the only proper remedy that we could have here is not only reversal, but to go ahead and remand with instructions to the Superior Court to enter a judgment of acquittal, since they cannot legally convict Mr. Banther. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the Court. In response to Mr. Gill's argument, I would point out that throughout these proceedings, and today in his argument, Mr. Gill accused the state of a number of ethical improprieties, including his statement today that we're willing to do anything to obtain a conviction. And our response to Mr. Gill throughout the proceedings has essentially been to occasionally say politely that these things are not true, and I'll limit myself to that here today as well. His accusations of impropriety are not true, and we tried very hard to comply with the rules in this case to do things the right way, especially given that the case was remanded several times and we had three trials. and the state believes that we did handle this case in an ethical way and in a careful way, and certainly did not intentionally commit any error or intentionally violate Mr. Banther's rights in any way. The state believed at the prior trials that, in fact, the killing had been planned in advance, believed that in good faith and based on the evidence, I think it was a reasonable conclusion based on the evidence. In this case, we had new evidence. We talked to John Schmitz, the detective did, for the first time in 2007, and for the first time we had an actual witness who was present at the scene and who gave us a description of what actually occurred. Based on that new significant evidence, after much consideration, we ultimately decided to present John Schmitz as a witness at the 2008 trial. We only did so after...
It was my understanding that after the prior proceedings in this court, Schmitz contacted the state and volunteered to come forward.
That is correct, Your Honor. We did not approach him. He approached us. That is correct.
And so he said something to the effect, I see you're having a problem with your case. Maybe I can provide some testimony that would support a different position or something to that effect.
It was a very brief letter to that effect sent to Mr. O'Neill. We had a detective go and talk to Mr. Schmitz. We got him a lawyer appointed to represent him, and he ultimately made a statement. In trial preparation, I interviewed him along with co-counsel and the detective, both before and during the trial, and the decision was made to call him only after carefully talking about the circumstances of the case with him and deciding that his version of what occurred was credible, that I don't know what happened, I wasn't there, but I reasonably believed what he said. The decision was also made to call him only after I looked at the case law and decided there was no due process violation.
His version was that Banther alone had committed the murder, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, in essence. That he was present, that Banther killed Ravers, and that he was then helped Banther to dispose of the body.
Well, that's where the record gets a little confused, but you can help us out since you did the trial. He testifies Banther alone kills Ravers. And the medical examiner seems to support that. But then he suggests that Ravers wasn't really dead as a result of Banther's conduct. And he was still alive when he was put in the barrel. And that's becomes the basis for the accomplice liability theory. Is that correct?
Well, that becomes one basis. Mr. Gill said in his argument that we provided a new basis in the supplemental memorandum, but actually that other basis was argued at the prayer conference in this trial. So that was not our
only. Just help me understand the facts where we go from the witness saying Banther alone killed the victim to the victim being alive and the Banther becomes an accomplice rather than a principal.
Well, factually, what Schmitz said was that he saw Banther take the axe, strike Ravers several times in the head. Ravers dropped to his knees, struck again, and he was lying there. He helped to carry Ravers into the truck, and that Ravers was still breathing. I think he said raspingly. The medical examiner was questioned about that, and he said that the blows to the head were certainly fatal, and anybody looking at the evidence would reach that conclusion. Nobody could survive such blows to the head. But he also said he couldn't say how long somebody might continue to breathe afterward. Most people would probably not continue to breathe for very long. The breathing is controlled in the brainstem, low in the head. But that some people might continue to breathe for quite a while. I'm paraphrasing his words. And Schmitz said that Ravers was still breathing when they got him. It was only about 2 miles or so when they drove him to the burn site, and when he and Banther put Ravers into the barrel and set him on fire. I don't think that testimony is inconsistent with the medical evidence, although the doctor can't say one way or the other whether Ravers would still have been breathing 5 or 10 minutes after being hit in the head. In the state's view, Schmitz's testimony on that point was credible. But there's no doubt that the blows to the head would have been fatal. It's possible that putting Ravers into the barrel would have accelerated his death in some way, although the doctor could not say that, and I don't think looked at that or was asked that back in 1997. I think Schmitz realizes, if you look at his testimony, because he was pressed on this point, realizes that the blows to the head were fatal, but if you look at his testimony and what he said, and I think he said this explicitly at one point, I think he does feel some responsibility for what happened, because Ravers was still breathing when he helped Banther put him in the barrel and set him on fire. And I don't believe he ever talked about that with his lawyer.
So just tell me the evidence that moves Banther from a principal to an accomplice.
Well, I think there is some validity to the, at least arguably some validity to the burn barrel theory. But I think primarily the
evidence...
Well,
there has to be a lot of validity to it if it's going to be submitted to the jury. So that's really my question. There's no doubt, based on Schmitz's testimony, which is up to the jury to assess, that Banther could be convicted at the third trial as a principal. Now the state is saying, but, you know, at the third trial, we could also convict Banther as an accomplice. So that's my question. What do we have to demonstrate that Banther wasn't the principal? Instead, he was the accomplice. And as I said in my question to Mr. Gill, we normally see cases where you charge someone as a principal, the evidence comes in, and we've said many times, if you charge someone as a principal, but the evidence shows they're an accomplice, they can be also, it can be submitted to the jury under an accomplice theory of liability. So my question is, what was the evolution in this case that changed Banther from the principal to the accomplice?
Well, you mean from trial to trial, Your Honor?
No, the third trial.
The third trial
starts out, the state's theory is, Banther's the principal, we're going to have Schmitz testify to that effect. But then the state, after all the evidence is in, said, well, you know, we don't want this to go to the jury on the theory of principal liability alone. We think as the evidence unfolded, we now have a basis for Banther being the accomplice rather than the principal. Therefore, we want to charge the jury on that. So that's my question. How did that happen in the third trial?
Well, I think that without Schmitz's testimony, the basis for Banther to be viewed as an accomplice was always present. As Mr. Gill said in his briefs, and it's accurate, the evidence presented at the third trial was the same as the evidence at the second trial, almost exactly. There was evidence that, from Banther's own mouth, that Schmitz struck Ravers in the head with the axe. There was evidence from his own mouth in his extensive tape statements that he met with Ravers that night for the purpose of resolving their differences, and he basically described a scenario in which a fight broke out, and he said that Schmitz struck Mr. Ravers in the head. However, if you look at the evidence in the case, and the jury, of course, is free to accept whatever evidence they believe or to put whatever reasonable interpretation on it they want, it was Banther who had about 90% of the motive to kill Mr. Ravers. Schmitz is about twice as big as Banther, and one could reasonably believe that it makes sense that he would have been the one actually to kill Mr. Ravers, who was also a tall guy, about 6'4".
So putting the burn barrel aside, the way I understand your answer is, since Schmitz and Banther were each saying the other struck the fatal blows, the jury could believe that in its entirety, or the jury could believe they were both involved. And to the extent the jury concluded based on their assessment of the competing credibility, they were both involved, the jury could properly convict Banther as an accomplice.
Right, and that's why we cited Norcross, or excuse me, Swan, in the supplemental memorandum. Basically, if the jury is satisfied that there's an accomplice-principal relationship, I don't believe the jury has to determine which defendant was actually the accomplice and which the principal. And there was abundant evidence from which they could have concluded that there was an accomplice-principal relationship here. The fact that immediately after the killing, they started working together to hide the body is an additional piece of evidence and support such an inference, which is one reason the state believed that Banther and Schmitz committed this crime together from the outset of this case. In fact, it's a strong inference.
Can I interrupt for a second? Do I understand you to be saying that the post-axing conduct with the barrel and all that is not the basis for your saying that there'd be accomplice liability?
I think it's part of the basis. It's not the only basis, but it's
part. Let's assume that didn't exist, that all you had was the evidence relating to the axing of the victim. Is it your contention that that evidence presented to the jury could support either a verdict against Banther for being the principal or an accomplice?
I believe that it could, although it wouldn't be as strong as with the additional evidence you've asked me not to consider. The fact that each pointed the finger at the other, the fact that there was evidence that they were close friends and that if a fight broke out, they may have supported one another. The fact that although Banther had about 90% of the motive and it was Banther who was involved in this confrontation with Mr. Ravers, the fact that Schmitz arguably also had some motive to be angry at Ravers because of $4,000 that he'd given to Banther to buy jeans, and Ravers, we believe, had the jeans, that would have supported such an inference as well. It's the state's belief that we're allowed to argue on the alternative, and I would cite the Ayers case, which is listed in the supplemental briefing. That's a case in which the state had a theory of principal liability on the part of the defendant, and during the course of the trial, apparently, an accomplice liability theory developed. And
there's no doubt the state can argue in the alternative, but you can see from Justice Berger's question and mine, what we're trying to have you identify is the evidentiary support in the record for the alternative theory. And my understanding is that the conflicting testimony is one basis for your alternative theory, but that you really do need the burn barrel evidence to support your alternative theory of accomplice liability.
Well, respectfully, I would disagree with that. I think that...
No, I'm just trying to understand your argument. So tell me your argument as long or as succinctly as you want, the evidence in the record to support the alternative theory of accomplice liability.
The evidence in the record is that if you don't believe Schmitz's testimony, if the jury did not believe Schmitz's testimony, that both Banther and Schmitz were present at the murder scene. There's evidence that a fight broke out, obviously, since Mr. Ravers was killed. Bruce Banther said that John Schmitz killed Mr. Ravers when a fight broke out. But there's evidence, abundant evidence, that Bruce Banther was angry at Dennis Ravers and had a motive to participate in an assault on Dennis Ravers. There's some evidence that John Schmitz also had such a motive. They were close friends. If a fight broke out, they would have... And there's abundant evidence that they were very close. If a fight broke out, they would have tended to support one another immediately after the killing, working together. They took the victim's body, tried to burn him in the burn barrel, and in that sense, the burn barrel evidence does apply. Then took him to Washington, D.C., put him in a parking garage. Several weeks went by. They went together and buried him in North Carolina. And that essentially is the evidence of accomplice liability. I think it's a strong inference from that evidence. If the jury doesn't believe Schmitz's testimony, which was subject to quite quite an attack on cross-examination on his credibility.
Although I'm not altogether sure I understand the significance of it, Mr. Gill suggested to us that you also introduced evidence that was consistent with prior planning and an agreement to commit the offense, and that essentially you bolstered your principal argument and your accomplice argument by using conspiracy theory evidence. You haven't mentioned anything about that as you've outlined your evidence supporting the accomplice liability theory. Do you agree or disagree with Mr. Gill? And do you understand Mr. Gill's legal point that there is apparently something wrong with that that implicates the due process clause?
I understand his point. I disagree with it. During the trial, he asked for a curative instruction, basically when there was nothing to cure. He asked, as various evidence was admitted, that the judge instruct the jury that the jury could not use this evidence to infer a conspiracy or an agreement, when, in fact, the jury hadn't heard any instruction. There was no danger they were going to infer a conspiracy or an agreement. And when they were charged, they were not charged with conspiracy, and they were told in the accomplice liability instruction, you can't premise accomplice liability on a finding of an agreement. The jury instruction itself, in that sense, was a curative instruction. So there was no danger that the jury would find any type of liability premised on an agreement or on a conspiracy. We never argued that. We didn't try to present that. There was evidence, as is often the case, which could support different inferences, in which if we had argued it might have supported a conspiracy, but all that evidence had independent relevance to the case as presented and the case as charged to the jury. And so I think Mr. Gill's argument that a curative instruction was necessary or that we somehow improperly presented evidence of a conspiracy is without merit.
So your point is, even though if there may have been evidence that was consistent with prior planning and an agreement, that one in the abstract could argue would underpin a conspiracy theory, it isn't a problem here because, A, that evidence that would have been consistent with the conspiracy theory had its own independent purpose and rationale for other reasons. Two, not only was Banther not charged with conspiracy, but you didn't argue a conspiracy theory to the jury, and that the final instruction made it clear that the jury would not confuse that evidence with a basis for accomplice liability. Are those your points?
Yes, sir. I don't think there's any chance that the jury could have convicted on a conspiracy theory or on a prior agreement theory because they were not so charged, and they were expressly told you can't convict on such a theory. Mr. Gill has not identified any evidence which would point only to a conspiracy or an agreement and was not admissible for some other relevant purpose. Those issues did come up at trial occasionally, and the judge admitted evidence which was relevant for purposes admissible in this trial, not relevant to conspiracy, not relevant to an agreement.
Okay. Do you agree that Mr. Gill said that the accomplice liability theory of the state was never argued to the jury?
The accomplice liability theory was briefly argued in the state's opening summation. Mr. Smith touched on it and said, I forget the exact words, but something to the effect, it's important to know you can convict him as an accomplice or as a principal. It was not argued in any detail. I don't think it's particularly effective to argue in the alternative, but the jury can certainly consider alternative theories and reach their own conclusions. And my concern was if they didn't believe Schmitz, they're left with a situation where they had to conclude Banther was guilty. The evidence is overwhelming, but they might have thought that if he didn't actually swing the axe, he couldn't be convicted, and that's why we gave that instruction, asked for that instruction.
Thank you, Mr. Welch.
Thank you.
Couple of quick corrections. This was not newly discovered, Mr. Schmitz. I thought Justice Holland's question was actually going there. Mr. Schmitz, in 1998, and this is found at pages 838 through 39 of the appendix, wrote to the state telling them basically the same thing. There's another letter which Mr. Welch was referring to in 2007, but the state had this, and they had Mr. Schmitz's offer 10 years prior to this trial. So this was not anything which was newly discovered. Secondly, and I can see, again, where Justice Holland got this impression, The state did not go into this trial with a theory that Banther was the principal and then change to add the accomplice as it went throughout. A close reading of the entire transcript, the state waffled back and forth throughout its entire case as to whether they were going to call Mr. Schmitz or not. They hadn't even made that decision until they got to the end of their case, past that medical examiner, actually. And that's why they never asked the medical examiner about, boy, could he still be breathing, you know, 10 minutes later, an hour later. They never asked those type of questions. So that was something which they actually made up basically on the fly there. But the conspiracy, if, as the state argued before this court and in its brief, that if on the burn barrel theory the jury could have gone ahead and convicted, the state has admitted that that was a conspiracy. And conspiracy is barred not just by that due process argument, is barred by this court's prior rulings, double jeopardy, and 11 Delaware Code Section 208.
Thank you, Mr. Gill. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.